everyone. Welcome to Critical Hit, a Major Spoilers Dungeons & Dragons podcast. So glad that you could join us this week. Oh, we're taking a break from the action, the super cool, fun action, as we often do, because we know that it angers you whenever we break away from the cool story that Rodrigo's telling. And so
whole point of this is to do things that people don't always do, and we're here to help.
And the other part about Critical Hit is that we're here to not only tell a fantastic story and have us have fun while playing these fantastic stories, but also to inform and educate those people out there who don't know anything about the game or who want to know more about the game, especially new dungeon masters or gaming masters. And Rodrigo,
we're going to help you poor bastards be as awesome as us.
Or at least as awesome as Rodrigo. Rodrigo, in this last episode that we had, one of the comments two episodes ago, whatever it was, when we were fighting the Jaguanas in the bushes, I had made the comment.
A memorable episode.
Yes, it was. Orym used his wizard's escape to pop out of existence in one bush that had a +2 of hiding and pop into an existence something like six squares away into another bush of +2 hiding. And I think right in the next turn or whatever, he was attacked by one of the Jaguanas. And my comment at that point was, well, would the Jaguana actually see me move and escape and do those kinds of things? And that made me wonder, how are we supposed to approach role-playing monsters in the game? And, you know, what kind of boundaries and rules do we set for monsters to make sure that their actions are believable and it's not just the dungeon master going, oh, look, I haven't picked on that character in a while. Let's go and fight him, or let's go and pay attention to this person over here.
Right. In a game, especially in a game like Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, where a lot of things are codified, and I mean, and if you think that there are some kind of problematic situations in 4th edition, you should try other games that don't have nearly as many rules, because sometimes there's just no way to within the rules to do something. But in a game where everything in 4th edition in the game is codified in the way that 4th edition is, you have to go by exactly the wording of what a power does, for example.
Right.
So in that situation, you know, Wizard's Escape doesn't allow you to hide. Ergo, you know, the monsters would have still been aware of you, regardless of what all was going on.
Sure.
That's something that as a game master, you know, sometimes there is kind of this back and forth negotiation of, oh, well, would the monster have seen this happen or not? In 4th edition, you know, there's all these class features and all this stuff going on, and you always have to assume that everybody more or less knows what's going on, even if they're not sentient creatures and stuff like that.
Okay.
Because otherwise, it really can complicate things, and you can end up making choices that, you know, take what would have been a normally fairly difficult fight into a very easy fight, or the other way around.
Well, and I don't have my monster manual here in front of me, so I just can't pull open an orc. But let's pick an orc, for example. If I remember correctly, doesn't it have things like intelligence levels of these characters and those kinds of things?
It does have intelligence ratings and things like that. But you have to remember that an intelligence rating is usually a measure of like actual like humanoid intelligence. So a pack of wolves is not intelligent at all. Like, they have a really low intelligence,
right?
But a pack of wolves is very coordinated. Usually when I play the monsters, I try to in fact have some sort of strategy that is believable for those monsters.
Okay.
The Jaguanas, for example, what they do is they fly down, they attack something, then they jump and attack something else. Then they jump and attack something else, and then they jump and attack something else. And whatever falls down first, which you guys never did, not fall down dead,
right,
they all swarm on and carry back to their nest.
Ah, okay.
But that never actually managed, you know, that was never actually managed to happen, because you guys always kept standing back up like jerks, you know?
Right.
You know, the pirates, for example, there were instances in the previous fight with the pirates where a pirate could have charged into a flanking position, but they didn't because, you know, they, you know, at the time I didn't see it, but it was also perfectly believable that these guys are not very cohesive unit.
Okay.
And just kind of swarm whatever vessel they attack, and it's something that's been working for them so far.
So, yeah. Matthew, how do we build up? I mean, you've been playing this for a long time, and Rodrigo, mm-hmm. you can answer as soon as Matthew's done. But how do you build a strategy for your monster fights? Rodrigo already says that there's a strategy for the Jaguanas, and if we ever encounter them again, we know that we better not die or we're going to get carried off to the nest. But how do you build a strategy when monsters fight?
Well, it's the terrible cliche, and it's very abused these days, is the villain of the story is the hero of his own head.
Okay.
So a lot of times now, granted, when I was playing AD&D, I briefly played 3.5 and hated it. But, you know, when I was thinking in terms of an AD&D concept, there were two things that I wanted to balance out, because A, you do want a fight to be challenging. And in AD&D, we didn't really have the challenge ratings per se the way they work now. Mm-hmm. So you were kind of trying to wrap something up. But you also wanted to avoid the problem of, it's kind of like the Dark Mirror thing that I hate so much, is sometimes, let's say you have a band of four characters and you want to challenge them. Your mind thinks, I should do four awesome characters who are just as awesome as these four characters.
Right.
If you do that, say, you're big fighter dude, you create this perfect analog to him. He's not necessarily going to be focused on, I'm going to fight, you know, the guy that you may have designed me to do. Because that character, in that character's mind, it's going to be, you know, about the strategy. What I want that character to do may not be the same thing that that character ends up doing or needs to do once the battle starts.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Rodrigo has said in the past that when you are the game master, you don't get to have a player character.
Right.
And I've played games where as the game master, I had a player character, and he's right. It's awful. But all the monsters are your player characters.
Right.
So if let's say you're in battle and, you know, Smith and Torque and Randus and Draco are surrounded by these guys, you have to think for in each of those person, your turn comes up. Okay. It's my turn to act in this person's shoes, in this person's skin.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's about what makes sense for that character to do. What does that character want to do in a fight?
Right.
And generally that answer is the same thing that the player characters want to do. They want to survive the fight, come out on top. And then, you know, they may have, you know, a certain, depending on who it is, they may have a certain thought process in mind.
Right.
They
basically sub goals to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. They may be protecting something. They may be attacking something. We had one battle where everyone, and this was something I can't remember now what it was. Oh God. It was like a power. But everyone picked one guy to fight, our big, giant, armored dude. All of the NPCs rolled, and I chose that they were all going to pile on the big guy, and the rest of the group didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it came to a point where, you know, I had to override what my dice were telling me because it wasn't making the story that I wanted, but I had to make the choices as those characters, and then you have to adjust with it. So I think you have to take into account what would these characters do?
Mm-hmm.
What makes sense for the story? And without cheating in favor of your party or TPK rules against your party, you also have to take into account what makes the best story.
Right. True. Rodrigo, go ahead and follow up with how do you approach this monster attack?
You know, running a monster is running a bunch of monsters is different from running a single PC. Partially because as a game master, I'm going in expecting these monsters to get rolled, you know, to mm-hmm. get killed. Mm-hmm. So that's one expectation that's kind of gone. I don't expect them to come out alive necessarily. The other thing is that means that I also have to describe what all the monsters do and their attitudes and stuff like that. And so I try to come up with shorthand and strategies ahead of time on how the monsters will act and what they do under certain situations. Now, the funny thing is that the basic thing is that usually non-sentient, basically animal intelligence creatures will run away if their numbers get dwindled or if they get injured enough.
Okay. Now, is there anything Is there anything in the monster manual that says if this?
Yeah, actually, in the Dungeon Master's Guide, it talks about, you know, basically how usually, for that matter, you know, in an actual fight, mm-hmm. and especially in, you know, in your fantasy, you know, high drama fights, you know, once a character gets knocked down to zero hit points, they're dying, but usually an enemy will not spend the time to walk over and waste their turn coup de grinding it. They will attack the next most credible threat.
Mm, okay. How do you define a threat then from the standpoint, again, and I'm going to go back to just some humanoid characters, not animal characters. Let's pick goblins or orcs or whatever.
No, pick one.
Okay, orcs. Level one orc. How about an orc bolt thrower? Level one XP of 100.
Okay, well, you got your bolt thrower and you got your big beefy orc in the front lines and you got mm-hmm. your grunts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That are all subservient to the big guy. Those guys are going to keep fighting as long as the big guy is there.
Okay.
And the big guy is probably going to find the biggest thing to fight because that's his job.
Okay.
And that's what he does, and that's what's going to give him the most orc glory.
So the frontline orcs. Fighting, the frontline orcs. The frontline orcs in this group. Are they going to be, I mean, you know, in archers, when you watch movies or when you watch, you know, big battles with archers, they just shoot their arrows up in the air and see where they're going to fall and hope they knock out as many people as possible. They don't sit there and target that one guy over there wearing the cloth shirt as opposed to the guy next to him wearing the leather. Except for protagonist
archers.
Shirt. Right.
I mean, except for archers with names who actually do,
so,
you know, track their quarry across the battlefield and do awesome things like that.
Is it these frontline orcs, the low-level orcs, does it make sense for them to then look for what they perceive to be the weakest character in the group and go after them as a whole? Or is it a tactic of everybody split up and take one, or fill in the blank? Well, is there something else?
I mean, it depends on what orcs do in your setting. Mm-hmm. I would say not generally. Probably if it's an orc war band, they're probably just going to rush in and hit whatever the closest thing is while the leader tries to find the other group's leader and beat them up.
Okay.
And by leader, that does mean the biggest one, because in the orc mindset, obviously mm-hmm. the biggest one would be the leader.
And we've seen that happen in other campaigns or other encounters that we've had where mm-hmm. they might all go after Torque and leave some guy alone.
Right, right.
But it also seems to, we've played so many different sessions and had so many different encounters. I'm sure there are times where a particular character was basically left alone in battle mm-hmm. in order just to fight, you know, to jump in and fight. And if he gets close and swings and hit, perhaps the reaction of that character is to swing and hit back. But if there's maybe a ranged character, maybe they can stand 20 feet away and just lob balls at, you know, fire bolts or whatever at somebody from 8 squares away. And as long as they're marked, or Torque or Sir Brinson or whoever is there in the way, they're going to basically leave the ranged attack person alone. Does that make sense?
It does that to the extent that any other strategy does. The other thing is, you know, what you'll see a lot is monsters will swarm somebody, you know, the first person there, if they're like a pack of wolf type monsters, mm-hmm. and then somebody will zap them, or somebody walks up and goes, "How about the monster?" and hits them, and of course the monster then turns around and attacks whatever just attacked them.
Right.
You know, if you guys, let's say that the Torkoal Tones are chasing down some kind of troll that just, you know, vandalized some village, and they surround them and they're going to beat him up and take back the stuff that he stole from the village. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, all of the trolls' pet giant rats show up around you guys.
Mm-hmm.
You guys aren't going to maintain the same strategy of let's all wail on the troll.
Mm-hmm.
You will probably have somebody turn around and take care of the rats, probably Orym.
Right.
So, you know, that you also have to consider that for the monsters is, as things change in the battlefield, the monsters also adjust their tactics. And if they're sentient monsters, for example, the candleheads, you know, Orym took one zap at them and they were like, oh, that guy's a caster. Let's all swarm him and kill him.
Right, right.
Because they're sentient, because they're highly organized, and because they probably already had some intelligence on you guys.
Mm, okay. That makes sense. No. That makes sense. What about in? I mean, we haven't done a lot of true military tactic fighting a lot of times in this.
Well, and real quickly, let me just say that actual military tactics and D&D tactics don't always match up as to what's good or effective.
Right.
There is definitely, you know, there is, if you're looking at a Venn diagram, they do intersect somewhere, but just because something is actually useful in, you know, real world combat does not mean that it's useful in D&D. Well, because for example, in D&D, if you run in a diagonal, you run a lot faster.
Yeah. And I know that there's a lot of checks that go on here, but let's say that we are chasing the orc and the swarm of rats come up behind us. Right. You would have to roll to see if there's a surprise, right? To see if they surprise us.
Well, usually roll.
Yeah, that.
Okay.
That there's. It depends. And as a game master, you have a lot of options on how to do this. The important thing is that in the end, you don't mechanically screw your players without giving them a chance.
Sure.
To prevent that from happening.
Sure.
So I feel perfectly justified in saying, and then all these rats that you didn't see before show up, but there's no mechanical bonus to the rats surprising you.
Sure.
They still go on their turn. You still go on your turn and nobody gets a bonus. Now, I could have the rats roll their stealth and then just randomly have rats show up next to you and attack you that you didn't see because they snuck up on you if they didn't beat your stealth check, or if they beat your stealth, or if your perception check didn't beat their stealth
check. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. No, that's the answer I was looking for, and hopefully other people will listen to this too. But, okay, let me go back and again put this in.
No, nobody's listening to this episode.
Let me go back and put this into terms of a magical character who has the ability to teleport from one point to another. Let's say you have your big tank is being swarmed.
My name is Tor.
No, tank. By two or three characters. They are all facing, they're in a line, and they're facing the character, the tank, right? If you teleported behind them, two or three squares behind them, as a game master, would you say one of them turns around and swings at the caster type behind him? Would that person know? Would that monster know that the person teleported behind them two or three squares? I mean, this goes back to a little bit of element of surprise.
Yeah. Right.
And almost
in D&D, there is no facing. So everyone is aware, is assumed to basically be bouncing back and forward on their toes. You know, parrying stuff behind them and then swinging forward and flipping around and doing awesome things all the time.
Okay.
Unless your power says, and there will be plenty of powers. In fact, there are, I think warlocks mostly have a lot of powers that allow them to teleport and then grant them combat advantage to someone else.
Okay.
Or have someone else grant them combat advantage, which is basically you pop somewhere else and that person doesn't see where you went. And then you get to zap them. It's kind of like briefly being hidden from them. Yeah.
Brenzen has that power.
Right. And, you know, the good thing about combat advantage is it can be anything. You know, rogues have a lot of powers where it's like you hit somebody so hard that they give you combat, that they grant you combat advantage. Well, that is, in fact, you hit them so hard that you stagger them. Or, you know, clerics have stuff where they just kind of raise their holy symbol and then all enemies for a while grant combat advantage to their allies. That's just, you know, them through divine power tilting, you know, all of the forces of, you know, nature and, you know, even like the laws of physics, just bending them to the will of their god and the will of the cleric and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's a good thing about having generally kind of, you know, non-defined bonuses and penalties is that you can flavor them however you want. So the important thing is that if Orym was to teleport behind the front line and zap some guys, then you could certainly phrase it. And especially if he hits, you can phrase it. You can, you know, describe it as that guy not seeing him. You know, unless the power itself or the ability itself says, and the guy doesn't see you, the other guy is assumed to have seen you.
Okay.
Just like you know, if the same thing was happening, if, you know, you guys were fighting teleport guys, and those guys teleported to the other side of you, you're also assumed to have seen them.
Sure. And that's kind of a little odd, you know, oddity, especially when you're dealing with a battle map that you can see from the third person perspective.
Yeah.
Makes it a little bit harder to say, but, or to get in that mindset of role playing that you don't see that big dragon behind you.
Well, and here's the thing. There have been times when monsters have made stealth checks against you guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's only been like one monster in a big fight, or there was one time when a monster made a stealth check to get away from you guys.
Mm, okay.
So that's not something that I've used very often. And none of you guys ever use stealth, largely because you're not trained in it. Even if, for example, if Brenzen was trained in stealth, he would still get like a -7 penalty to it. Cause he's actually wearing a tank.
Right.
So we don't deal too much in situations of whether a monster sees you or not, or whether you see a monster or not, because nobody's used stealth so far. You know, it's one of those resources like flying and like, you know, a couple other things that just really haven't come up in the game.
Okay. So I guess bottom line is it's a good idea for dungeon masters or game masters to sit down and figure out how do these monsters work in their game setting that have some basic strategy, but then also be aware that they need to change that strategy as the battle goes on.
Right. Well, and it is important. I think it is important to in fact keep that role play perspective at all times. Don't just turn it down into tactics, because it actually makes fights go faster, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And B, it actually, it enhances the experience of it as well.
Okay. Matthew, what were you going to say?
I honestly find that, to my mind, and this is not a shot at anybody, Rob, when someone on the field is calling tactics, there's a problem that I have. There are actually two problems. The primary problem is that each round is how long? 3 seconds?
Six seconds.
Okay. So each round is supposed to take 6 seconds. I don't necessarily like the break it down in your head and look at all angles and see, that to me kind of feels a little bit like a cheat. But then there's also the question of tactics and, you know, tactical stratagems and all of the thingamabobbity boos don't necessarily, I guess there's kind of a language to it. For me, some of the tactics that we've been involved in don't make a whole lot of sense from a Torque perspective, from a Matthew perspective. When I'm thinking as the game master, there are times when, you know, you've got a thumbnail sketch in your head of what you think these monsters are going to do, and it's not working, and the monsters have no idea. You know, they have no chance, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you have to think, am I going to have them stick with that? Am I going to have them come up with something on the fly? And in that time frame, you have to sort of take into account what's, well, honestly, quickest, but what's also going to make for the best story. I mean, the one time that we really screwed up, we were really outmatched and outpowered, turned into one of the most amazing segments of Critical Hit. And that's the point where the exploding skeletons charged up and critted us 3 times, 2 times in a row.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rodrigo had to go into that knowing those skeletons. You know, okay, and when this happens, I'm going to blow up in somebody's face, and they're all going to die, and then Orym's going to spend 6 weeks being tortured by the souls of his dead friends. You know, but that moment, obviously, he had no idea that was going to happen, and we had no idea going into that, you know, what necessarily the tactics were. And I think that situation is emblematic of why, yes, you want to have an idea of what you can do and what the characters can do. But you also want to leave wiggle room. You want to leave that moment where you can say, you know what, this isn't working, and the Jaguanas are now going to rip out Orym's throat and all do a backflip and be really impressive, and Orym will be really impressed, even though he's dead.
And I will just say real quick that you can have like basic templates for your monster's behavior. You know, if you can have, you know, non-sentient animals, you can generally have them all behave the same way. especially, mm-hmm. you know, obviously most of the things that you'll face are predators. So mm-hmm. they'll fight until they feel that they're losing and then get away, or well, try to get away.
Sure. You know, that brings up one of the, real quick, an alpha male.
Uh-huh.
What we would sometimes assume, I guess, would be if we were fighting a pack of wolves and we killed the alpha male, the rest would immediately, or not immediately, but pretty close, flee. Right? Or not?
Well, not necessarily. Okay. I mean, it depends what they're fighting you for. If they're fighting you for because they want to eat you, they wouldn't necessarily stop because the alpha is dead. In fact, that's more of something that sentient things would do. If you kill the main orc, the rest of the orcs are more likely to flee than if you kill the main wolf, because the other wolves still have to feed their cubs.
Sure.
Okay,
I'm sorry. I just interrupted real quick to see how that fit in. What was the next one that you were going to say?
But that's another one. You have like kind of tribal setups where if the leader goes down, then either the enemies are demoralized or confused or don't know what to do or just leave. Mm-hmm. You have your general cowardice where like if their numbers get depleted past a certain point, they'll just flee.
Right.
General cowardice.
Yes. You can have basically you step on a slab and the golem automatons that are guarding this temple attack you. Those guys
statues.
Aren't. The statues are never going to stop attacking. In fact, depending on how they're animated, the heads will probably roll after you long after they've been defeated. That sort of thing. Your average dragon and, you know, of course, dragons aren't supposed to be average, but it's hilarious because there is a dragon at every level that you can fight, so there's actually tons of them. You know, story-wise, dragons aren't very common, but in the book, they kind of are. A dragon will fight for as long as, you know, he thinks he has the advantage. He is very, you know, even your dumber dragons are kind of opportunists. What ends up happening a lot of the time, though, in most fights, is that you get past that point where, as a game master, you're like, aha, okay, well, we started out with 20 Jaguanas, and now the players have whittled them down to 5 Jaguanas, all of which are bloodied. It is now time for their instincts to kick in and for them to take off, at which point your wizard turns around and goes, they're all slowed! And the rest of the party and we surround the rest of them, so then you actually, you know, now the Jaguanas are fighting for their lives. Mm-hmm. But now that the players have the upper hand, they actually can't escape.
Okay. Anything else we want to add on this? Matthew, you had mentioned a moment ago about Orym being tortured and tormented by the deaths of his characters. We've had listeners write in, and we'll get to some listener email in a moment, but we've had some listeners write in and say, I want to play an evil character. I want to play shadow classes. and we'll talk about shadow classes in just a moment. But
well, I hope not.
Is it something, Rodrigo, is an acceptable, maybe not in your game, but is it acceptable maybe for a character to have that fresh scrubbed face, look at the world through these rose-colored glasses, I'm good, I'm doing it all for the good, and then just event after event beats this person down until they eventually turn inward on themselves and say, you know what, screw everybody, I'm in it for me now, and essentially turn, not chaotic evil, but maybe turn unlawful good, or maybe just unlawful or anything like that.
Lawful neutral.
Lawful neutral, maybe.
Possibly even lawful evil.
Although lawful neutral is not too bad, actually. But you don't want to be as chaotic neutral, because then you just implode it on yourself.
Neutral always turns bad.
Yeah. That's perfectly reasonable, and it's perfectly reasonable for your character to go through this and eventually feel that, you know what, every time I try to do something good, it just turns back in on me. No one ever thanks me for the good things I do. I'm going to stop being good. However, you also have to look at the game's themes.
Mm-hmm.
If the game has heroic themes and has strictly heroic themes, and it's just been kind of a series of problematic events that have turned this character less than good, or maybe just that the game master hasn't handled it right, or just, you know, that you feel that this character would naturally just go down this path, you have to be careful. And it's something that you have to talk about with your game master, because if it gets to a point where the character turns evil in a good game, then you can't play that character anymore.
Unless, as soon as he does
something evil, the rest of the party is going to turn around and beat him over the head.
Sure. Would there be a, could there be one of those Darth Vader type characters, who is, it starts out good and then is corrupted, and then there's a redemption at the end?
Sure. But the problem is that if that's a PC, well, there's two issues with that. Assuming that it is, that it does happen and that it gets pulled off properly, then that's kind of a thing where, like, you're playing your character, then you stop playing that character once he turns evil, and he basically becomes an NPC for the game master to use. And then eventually that character comes back and redeems himself. And if he survives, his own redemption, then he gets to maybe come back and join the party and apologize to his friends and whatever.
Okay.
The problem with the Darth Vader scenario is that Darth Vader, for the, you know, prequels, was the protagonist. He was the main character. All other characters kind of revolved around him. In a game where you have four players, you can't really have that. You can't really have somebody be the main character, because other players are going to basically do everything in their power to screw up that plot, even if they're not aware of it. Mm-hmm. You know, as a game master, like, I have tons of ideas, only probably a quarter of which at most I get to use, because you guys render the rest of them unusable. Yeah. And that's fine. And that's part of the fun of the game. Right. But you can't sit down with player A and say, okay, let's tell an awesome redemption story with your character in which you slowly turn evil and then.
No, I know you can't do that. Well, but Torque. Let's pick Torque, for example. Very innocent. What are you, Matthew? Is Torque neutral? Is he lawful good? What is his placement?
I would say that Torque is probably in the neutral good range.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say he's
probably either neutral good or maybe lawful neutral.
You know,
going to insert something, an addition issue here real quick.
Okay.
In fourth edition, there are only like four alignments. There's only good, lawful good, evil, and chaotic evil, and unaligned. So there's actually five.
Okay.
Which is, you know, if you're going to have alignment at all, why restrict it so much? But I think basically they restricted it to those because players who play chaotic neutral characters are so obnoxious that they wanted to just ban all the problematic alignments. Sure. That said, I don't pay a lot of attention to alignment as it is. If you guys feel that it's a good guideline for you to say my character is true neutral or my character is lawful good, then that's fine. But it's probably not something that's necessarily going to come into play except for actually monsters like demons and angels who are literally embodiments of good and evil.
Right. So Fresh Face Torque is no longer a police officer. He doesn't necessarily have to uphold the law. You know, maybe his upbringing. And I'm just don't anybody take that I'm saying that this is what Torque is or anything like that.
This is not canon.
Yes, this is speculative. But let's just say Torque is just basically having a hatful of what's going on. And he realizes that in his quest to bring down the void or to stop the evil, that it's acceptable to have losses that are not directly to the party. For example, they're running through a crowd. Acceptable losses. They're running through a crowd, and the candleheads are about ready to take a big snacky snack, and Torque just pushes an innocent bystander in the way. And that's an acceptable loss so that he can continue with his quest. That is actually not necessarily a good thing, and might be one of those indicators that this character is going down a not-so-good path. And while the rest of the party might say, probably not the coolest thing to do, they understand that this is for the good of the party and the good of the end goal, to the point where at some point Torque has no problem allowing the void gods to maybe wipe out an entire village so that he can gain a tactical advantage.
Does the rest of the party do that? I mean, here's the thing. It's a huge assumption that the rest of the party isn't going to do something about it. And that's the issue with this issue. Is that you start out and you say, well, maybe if this happens, then this happens and this happens, Torque turns evil. But right. you get to this happens, then Randus does this, then Rob doesn't do this. Mm-hmm. And then now Torque is back to actually being even more of a, you know, fresh-faced innocent than he was before. You know, he gets his redemption before the evil moment actually happens. So it's all very chaotic, and it's kind of a thing where you have to, I think what you have to do as a role player is you have to figure out what the character's core is. Mm-hmm. What about him is actually never going to change? Or rather, what is the prism through which they see the world?
Right.
And as you go, the characters may become, you know, darker or meaner or friendlier or more mm-hmm. talkative or less talkative, or will in fact start embracing the fact that sometimes you have to have these losses, or right. might embrace the fact that sometimes you have to cause these losses, or they might not. But that, even those tactics are themselves kind of far out from what the core of the character is. Yeah. So that's the important thing to keep in mind.
Okay, yeah. That kind of brings me to this idea of the shadow class. Matthew, you said, oh God, let's not talk about the shadow class. But this past week, I believe this is the 24th, if this is indeed the day that this, or the 23rd, if this episode goes up the way it should. This past week, Wizards of the Coast released Dungeons & Dragons Player's Option Heroes of Shadow, which is all about shadow classes. And in this, we meet some new character classes. We get the Assassin, the Paladin, the Vampire, and the Warlock. Now, I know we have some of these characters before, with maybe the Vampire being the newest class. Is that correct, Rodrigo?
Right. It's two new classes, unless you've had Insider, because Assassin has been around online.
Okay.
But it's two new classes and then two new options for old classes, two new options for Paladin and Warlock, I believe.
Okay, yeah, here's the Paladin description. Most Paladins embody virtue, and they channel the holy virtues to defend their allies, but not all cleave to such high-minded ideals. Shadow power can be channeled through anger, fear, and consuming desire for control. A Blackguard is a striker who taps into the menacing facets of the divine through the dreaded vices, dark emotion and ambition, rather than high ideals. Heroic Blackguards are dark warriors who combine heavy weapons and armor with fearsome deific might.
Deific.
That's it. Deific might. So that's how they would describe the Paladin in this new realm. Matthew, why don't you like shadow classes?
I don't not like shadow classes, but much like Rodrigo's ranting about chaotic neutral. And by the way, as an addendum to the previous discussions, apropos of nothing, Darth Vader is actually lawful evil. And chaotic neutral works really well in the form of the Ninth Doctor. Now, going back to what we're talking about.
Yeah, but the Doctor is not a player character.
That's not the point. Okay. You have a point, but that's not the point.
Okay.
The problem with the shadow characters for me is not what they represent. It's the fact that in my mind, when I see these kind of expansions, I know that this is what I'm going to be looking at in every group, in every game, in every online forum, probably for the next, I don't know, 6 to 12 months.
Right.
It's kind of like the point where, I don't know if you guys ever played City of Heroes back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You remember when they brought out the City of Villains expansion?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, all of the villains were basically, well, all the heroes were basically Wolverine and the Hulk. And Batman, or Batman Wolverine Hulk, or right. Hulk Bat Wolverman. But all the villains all of a sudden were either, you know, slinky chicks, so they were all these dark and brooding, mysterious, poke you in the eyes, or I don't necessarily have a problem with the concepts. I don't have a problem with, you know, shadow characters in general. But to me, a dark paladin seems to be a contradiction in terms that really only exists so that you can be dark and brooding. Anytime my friend Daniel, years ago, when we would play, he would start with this concept, and he was like, I want to be MacGyver, only dark and brooding. I want to be Jack from Tales of the Gold Monkey, only dark and brooding.
Right.
I, you know, it bothers me in that the tools can be so... The tools can be abused by the tools. It's kind of like, you know what I really love? I love Brandon Lee as the Crow. I love Jay O'Barr's Crow comic book. I loathe every single, not every single thing, but probably 80% of the things that were inspired by, influenced by, and designed to evoke the movie The Crow and the comic book The Crow.
Right. Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. You're up.
Okay. Here's an important thing about RPGs and kind of the story that you tell with an RPG is, you know, in a game like D&D, and especially in older editions of D&D, this one's a little bit better about it. You would open the Dungeon Master's Guide and there would be charts and you would roll and say, this town has 6 paladins living in it, which right. of course is ridiculous. But, what I'm getting at is that, you know, like the reason why it's okay that there's a dark paladin class is because in any given game world, there should be one blackguard. And that can very well be your PC, and that's fine. But there certainly can't be 2 of them. It's how in Critical Hit, Orym is actually the first sword mage ever. You know, no one's ever thought to actually channel magic through a sword before.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, why would you?
There's magic, there's wands, there's staffs, there's orbs. This
because
is
mages
crazy.
Can't carry bladed weapons. They can't. They can't. Nope. La 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 la, I'm not listening.
All right. Well, we'll just pick you up with the DeLorean when you're done hanging out in 1967.
First of all, it was 1989. And second of all, shut up.
Okay, so here's what's cool. In some of this discussion that we're having about the shadow classes, the newest one, Vampire. Now, many of our listeners have probably fought the Vampire. In their game settings, and it goes through the races. You've got a halfling, the Vryloka in there. Those are basically the 2 types of classes that that you can have. But then it goes in and starts talking about alignment, and it starts talking about how do you roleplay a heroic vampire, which is, you know, maybe not something. I mean, maybe we're talking about the Tom Cruises and the
whatever the
other kind of vampires, the Twilighty vampires that people so
you
want
said
to
it.
Play.
Okay. So there's a reason. Sure, there's a reason why Twilight is so popular. There's a reason why Interview with the Vampire not so much. There's a reason to a large extent why people, you know, played Vampire the Masquerade not the way that it was kind of meant to be played originally, which is to say have heroic vampires. And the redeemed bad person, the person who did not choose to become a vampire but is now making the best of it, there's stock in that. And it's something that has kind of become a cliche.
Right.
But it's also something that is to this day evocative. And if, you know, if you're getting somebody who's just getting into D&D, who's maybe not has been exposed to this much fiction as we have, which is, you know, understandable. I mean, between the 3 of us, we've, you know,
pretty much
we could probably choke a buffalo with the amount of comics that we've read, which I will admit is a weird way to put it. You know, somebody who's just coming in and is like, oh, what if I play a vampire who is good? You know, it's like, well, you know, let that person play that vampire.
Sure, have fun, Hannibal King.
Exactly.
Now we've got a new class that's coming out, Rodrigo. What would happen if, I don't know, one of the people, I'm just saying, somebody in a party says, oh, man, we're right in the middle of this epic storyline. I sure wish I could play I really wish that I could play a vampire. This was a vampire character. Now, you've addressed that in my desire to play Drunken Monkey by giving me a second character to play in the Celestial Crusade, which is fine. But would it be allowed for someone to be turned into a vampire?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean,
or if
really,
Brinson wanted to become this blackguard, he could do that.
Yeah, I mean, if there was something within the context of the game, and you have, I think that's the sort of thing that has to happen, is in those magical, amazing events that nobody planned for,
right?
To a certain degree. I mean, it's, you know, it's how Randus, it's why Randus looks the way he does now, you know. There's a prestige or a paragon path that Randus can go into because you guys lost that fight, which no one ever planned for. So if something was to happen to Sir Brenzen and he decided to channel his rage into, and turn his back on his church, but somehow still continue to pursue the goals of the party. Right. Then yeah, totally. I mean, there's no reason why that can't happen. And I am all for out and out breaking the rules if it'll actually cost something that will not only be interesting, because sometimes people are like, well, this would be interesting. It's like, and then what freaking story are you going to tell?
Yeah, but he's got no mask now and he works for Iron Man. How many stories are you going to do?
Exactly. That is exactly the point. Is somebody's like, well, my character's a were-tiger now. It's like, well, good job, idiot. Now your character's a were-tiger. Like, the party has to stop everything they're doing every night to keep you from rampaging across the countryside. You are hindering the story. So as long as whatever happens propels the story forward, you know, if Orym gets turned into a vampire and the only way to turn him into a not vampire is to kill, you know, the vampire lord that turned him into a vampire, and that's what the rest of the story is going to be about, then sure. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure, Frog Brothers.
I was going to say, I'm sure someone's going to go into town and say, I've been living here for years. One thing I can't stand is all the vampires.
All the damn vampires.
Dungeons and Dragons.
Why do you think they call it Moonhole?
Player's option, Heroes of Shadow is out now. The hardbound book, $29.95, although Wizards of the Coast said $24.95, but here I can clearly see it says $29.95 on the back cover. 158 pages.
First of all, you cannot clearly see anything.
Shut up, you! 158 pages of new spells, new tactics, new ways of dealing with characters. Me personally, even though I spend my life on the internet, I kind of like having the hardbound book because it's, to me, a little bit easier to look up stuff. Plus, you've got the fantastic illustrations. But for those of you who are living the D&D insider life, Rodrigo already said the assassin character has been available online for a while. Here's the cool thing. The day that this book was released, on the 19th of April, all of the content appeared live the same time on the D&D Insider site. So if you don't want to go out and buy the book, but you're really interested in playing the vampire, it's there in D&D Insider if you have it, which I think is very cool. So check it out. I mean, there's some new stuff that you can do with some new characters to maybe incorporate and increase your gameplay. Okay, here's a question that just popped up this afternoon. Dear Critical Hit, my name is Liam. I've been buying D&D material for about a year. Without really getting anyone together, you guys inspired me to get my stuff together and sit down with some friends. We've already had one session to see what we thought of the game, and everyone enjoyed it. The main problem is that I'm serving as the game master. However, a friend of mine is hosting the events at his house, or apartment, or whatever. It doesn't say. It just says his hosting. We had a party of four last session, and now he's invited more people to join. It seems cruel to tell them that they got their hopes up, but at the same time, I'm worried about DMing for a group of seven or eight. What should I do? Thank you, Liam.
Okay. No. You don't have to run for those people. As the game master, you decide to run for whoever you want or for the people you want. And nobody else gets to invite anybody else. They can talk to you about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the game master decides who shows up to his game, or rather, who they invite. I guess the individual person decides whether they show up or not.
Right.
But so if this other person is hosting, you know, they do have some social leverage to say, hey, I want you to invite my friends. It's all good. And, you know, it's definitely have an adult discussion about it. But nobody else gets to invite people to your game. Hilariously enough, that's how I met D&D Brian, because Alex just invited him to my game, which I gave Alex a stern chewing out for, but, you know, sometimes it can turn out okay. Just make sure that, you know, have an additional session or have an additional one shot in which you play with other people and see if you want to invite them into the game. But don't let other people invite people to your game. It can get out of control quickly and it can turn into politics, which is, you know, you want to keep to a minimum.
Matthew, do you agree or have any other thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I've actually lived this, and I will tell you that one way that I found, and it was incredibly passive aggressive and hateful, was when 13 people all of a sudden started showing up. I started trying to game for 13 people and nobody had any fun, least of all me, and people started dropping out. And as long as I was able to mitigate the damage and try and manipulate the ones, you know, that I wanted to stay into staying, eventually I had a very solid group of six people.
Okay.
Because a group of, you know, I would say a group of more than eight is pretty much untenable unless somebody's drunk, and probably the game master would have to be the one who drinks. Large group dungeon mastering is an entirely different game, but Rodrigo's point stands. Even if your friend provides the venue, it's still your game. And I think you got to be straightforward. You got to say, look, I understand that you got to invite Becky because she's sleeping with your cousin or whatever, but you can't just jump into the game. So, you know, what I would advise is, as hateful as this is in a compromise, as damaging as observers can be to a round, I think that if the people show up, and, you know, go ahead and deal with them as observers, because having too many players is much more disruptive than having distracting people watching.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And actually I used to run, actually most of my gaming career has happened in dorms, in college dorms. And I've actually had probably an inordinate amount of people just show up to my games and watch, which I guess weirdly prepared me for the stresses of, running a game publicly in Critical Hit. Mm-hmm. But, if you're just straight up with them, you know, if somebody shows up and you're like, hey, why are you doing here? Oh, well, you know, I'm a friend of Ben's and I'm just here to watch. Okay. We'll sit over there. Try not to say anything. If you have any questions, wait for a break in the action and we can talk about it. That'll be a lot better. Certainly, you know, don't necessarily just scream your head off at them, unless you know them well.
I would pretty much avoid that anyway, because even if it's not a thing, you can't always avoid the politics. And if, mm-hmm. if somebody is hosting that game, he may feel like it's his game. You know, you may be the one coming up with it, but it may feel like his game because it's in his house at his table and everybody's bogarting all of his food. So,
well, you know, to be honest, that's basically how Critical Hit runs. I host, mm-hmm. I record, I do all the magic-y magic behind the scenes, and Rodrigo puts the game together. It's up to him to decide who he wants in there or who he doesn't want in there. And we've had Alex, I think, is dying for a seat at the table. And it's up to Rodrigo to make that decision, not me. So. And I'm perfectly fine with that. Michael says,
Rodrigo likes to torture us because he's like, I'm going to give Steven wants to play this new character. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give Matthew something that he will hate.
Gives you a better appreciation for the character that you play all the time.
You like it.
Michael writes in and he says, hey, guys, love the podcast. Keep up the great work. I'm currently playing a Beastmaster Ranger with a bear companion. And it's working out pretty good. However, my companion has a terrible bonus to attack. I've looked through items and feats and have found no solution. I was wondering if you guys had any good solutions to this problem.
Really? The bear has a bad bonus to attack?
That's what it says.
I guess it may be a little lower than the other ones because its damage is so high. But I don't know. That's weird. I thought that the bear was actually one of the more dominating companions, with the only real drawback that it's a bear and you can't take it into a freaking city. But
it's a midget bear.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't aware. I honestly, there are ranger powers, I think, that will give your animal companion a bonus to attack. Maybe like equal to your wisdom or something. I think I've seen some. There are certainly ones that give him a bonus to damage. The other thing is largely what the Beastmaster Ranger is good about is having, you know, it's nice to have this animal companion and have him attack, but a lot of the time it's good to just have him there to flank and to throw out opportunity attacks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when something tries to move away from you. If you find that the bear's attack bonus is not what you want, then maybe focus more on ranger powers, on actual, you know, double sword stabby stab attacks, and have your bear more as backup and place him strategically to hinder the enemy.
Okay. Jason writes in and says, "Hey guys, thank you so much for this podcast. About a year and a half ago, I was invited to play my very first game of D&D. Unfortunately, four sessions in, the game fell apart when our DM decided to go back to school and change careers. Ever since, I've been wanting to get back into D&D. I have no experience playing the game, but decided that if I wanted to play with people my own age, I'm nearly 30, I would have to run it with my wife's siblings. I started listening to your show at episode 1 earlier last week, and I'm now on episode 13. I've already learned so much from Rodrigo about what to do and what not to do as a DM, so I'm thankful that I have someone to learn from that can show me the ropes while helping others at the same time. Not only that, but I'm also entertained by Torque and his various antics. Thanks again, guys. I'm looking forward to another 80-plus hours of Critical Hit." That's from Jason. And Jason, thank you so much for that. And you know what, listeners? Here it comes. You've probably been waiting the entire episode for this. We want to continue Critical Hit. We want to make sure that Critical Hit continues for a very, very long time. Some of you do know, though, that Critical Hit is one of our most expensive productions that we do at Major Spoilers, even though we have a website and we've got the Major Spoilers podcast and everything else that we do as part of the Major Spoilers experience. We would certainly appreciate anybody who thinks that this show is worth a couple of bucks to throw a couple of bucks our way. A couple of weeks ago, we launched the recurring donation button. A lot of people have donated to the show, and we appreciate that. A lot of people have thrown us 20, 30 bucks here and there. Some people have said, "Hey, guess what, guys? It would be easier if you just withdrew a certain amount of money from my account every week." And I would certainly do that, and that would help you guys out in the long run. So that's why we have these recurring donations. If you're so inclined, there's no obligation for you to do this. But if you think that this show is worth a couple of bucks, we'd sure appreciate it if you head over to majorspoilers.com and click on one of the recurring monthly donations. You could do $2 a month. You could do $5 a month. You could do $10 a month. I mean, $2 a month, that's only 26 bucks a year. It automatically is withdrawn from your account. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about finding a donation button or doing anything like that. Personally, I think
67 cents a day.
$2 a month is actually a pretty good deal when you're getting four Critical Hit episodes.
Torque is a young orphan from Moonhold. Now that his family is gone, Torque takes a lot of upkeep. For only 67 cents a day, you can help feed Torque funnel cakes.
Well, if you think about it, four episodes, you're looking at, what, 50 cents a show? What a bargain. You can't even listen to NPR these days without being constantly
interrupted. You can't play a video game for 50 cents anymore. Hell, depending on where you live, you can't even back out of your driveway without somebody wants 50 cents.
I have a challenge to all the Critical Hit and Major Spoilers listeners who listen to our shows. I would love to see 100%. I would love to see 100% buy into this. I've got a magic number in my head, and I know that we have at least that many listeners. Actually, we have a little bit more than that.
Because three,
no, it's not three. We've actually had a lot of people jump in and get on this recurring donation. I'm very, very grateful for that. But I'm looking for 100% buy-in from all the Critical Hitters, from all the Spoilerites. If you guys can do that, it will ensure that Critical Hit continues into the long, long future from now. It'll allow us to do some other good things that we've been wanting to do and a lot, lot more. So if throwing that out for your consideration, if you'd like to do it, we would be appreciative of that. Because, you know, it does kind of cost a bit of money to do this every week. All right. Anything else, gentlemen, before we get out of here this week? We should have a show next week. At least that is the plan. But there are some events going on in our lives at this moment that might throw things off by a week, which might be another great reason for people to think about making that recurring donation. Yeah. If you want to know a little
bit more
about
this,
that,
we're not doing this on purpose. We're not like trying to hold off on you or anything. I just, I'm busy at work.
Well, Rodrigo's busy at work. I've got a thing going on in our household, and Matthew has a thing going on all the time.
A toenail. It's in growth.
And then, of course, there's Rob and D&D Brian and everybody else that's involved in this.
They've got nothing going on, but they showed up for a show without us, and it just turned into two guys sitting there getting drunk.
If you want to know a little bit more, tune in onto the Tuesday Major Spoilers podcast, and you can find a little bit more about that. But until next time, here's hoping all of your dice rolls are critical hits.
information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.